Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 27th already of June. Our guest this hour is the author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Nicholas Schmidl is a fellow at the New America Foundation, writes for the New York Times Magazine, Slate, The New Republic, Smithsonian, and the Virginia Quarterly Review. As a fellow of the Institute of Current World Affairs, he lived and reported in Pakistan for 2 years. And this guy is fearless. He was only 27 years old when he went to Pakistan, newly married, and would go just about anywhere and risked his life probably to be able to tell us all these stories in this very, very compelling book. We're going to be welcoming phone calls as we carry on this conversation with Nicholas. So feel free to join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. Hi, Nicholas.
Good morning, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you.
All right. You are one fearless guy. I can't believe that you went there and went where you went. And you were only 27 years old when you started all of this.
Right. Well, I think that actually my wife deserves more credit. She was only 25, and she's the one who thought that the idea of moving to Pakistan for 2 years after, 2 months just after being married was a good idea. So I sort of defer all credit to her. But no, it worked out, you know, very well, and I was able to make the sort of connections over the course of the 2 years that I lived there, to be able to go places that many other journalists have not been able to go.
You sure did make connections. And she also, well, she helped you out in several occasions, but she worked, she was the first non-Muslim American to ever be at the International Islamic University. That's interesting.
That's right. She, we were there for about 6 months, and she had gone through her sort of going out and taking artistic pictures of everything and then painting everything. She'd gone through all these phases, and she said, you know, all right, I'm starting to go a little crazy. I need to do something. So she enrolled at the university, and as you mentioned, she was the only non-American Muslim the only non-Muslim American to ever attend the university. She also, though, as you know, and I'm sure we'll discuss this later, but as we were eventually kicked out of the country after 2 years, she had just begun hosting a reality TV show in which she was making over, she was in Urdu, she was making over Pakistani women. So she was just kind of all over the place and had become this sort of public celebrity. I was riding on her coattails by the end.
That's quite a story. The connections, her connections, your connections, and this takes us in many directions, but you write early on, the connections mean everything. If you knew the right people, things worked out. If you didn't, you wound up on a one-way flight to Dubai on a rainy Tuesday night, but you could also wind up dead, certainly, which is, you know, one of the scary things about the adventure that you were on. But the connections, I guess this is true in lots of places, but it's a matter of life and death in the work that you were doing.
Right. I mean, it you know, as you mentioned, there were instances when knowing the right people got us out of trouble. There were instances when, having the right business card in my pocket got me out of trouble. And yet, those things were all sort of on the spot using connections. The problem was that if you knew the wrong people is when you began sort of getting into the bad graces of the intelligence agencies. And my contacts with insurgents in the province of Balochistan, which borders Afghanistan and Iran, my contacts with various jihadis in the Swat Valley, my very close contact with Abdul Rashid Ghazi, who was the head of the Red Mosque up until the time of his death in July 2007, these were the sorts of connections that the government certainly didn't like that I had fostered these and had developed these to such an extent. And so ultimately, those are the ones I believe that led to them deciding to kick me out.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the process you go through as a journalist. In order to get the kind of depth that you have in this story, you have to, I don't know if befriend is the right word or not, but you became, you got his trust. You got Ghazi's trust, actually, and it allowed us to see a different part of Pakistan through that relationship you had with him. And yet I'm thinking, on the other hand, this must be a hard thing to do, because here you are with somebody who a lot of people here would consider a horrible terrorist, somebody who wants to get America, and somebody we want to shun at all costs, and yet you are presenting Pakistan to us, and you have to have that relationship to present Pakistan.
Right. Well, I mean, there are a couple of ways to go about answering this question. I mean, the first thing is that I had a great advantage in going to Pakistan that, you know, as I've done magazine stories since, haven't had the same opportunity. And that was that I could be there for a very long time before I really started reporting, in that I was there on this two-year writing fellowship. And the first 4, 5, 6 months, I mean, I was mostly learning Urdu, traveling the country, writing these newsletters for this foundation, but, you know, they were being shown to like 200 people. It was a very small circulation. And it allowed me to get my feet under me and to sort of start establishing, you know, the language is a huge thing. So when the first time that I went, sure, and I met this Abdul Rashid Ghazi and I could speak some Urdu with him, and I was genuinely and sincerely interested in knowing what he thought, what he felt, et cetera, and I wasn't just going in for sort of a quick hit quote, I think that slowly sort of allowed him to open up and to build some trust. Because there are only two people that have a lot of time on their hands, that have a lot of money that allows them to live in Pakistan for 2 years without necessarily even writing. And those are either scholars or unfortunately, spies. And I think that Ghazi, I believe, thought that I fell into the former category, which is very fortunate, because if he just thought that I would have fallen into the latter, it could have been terribly unfortunate.
Right.
And so that, you know, just that genuine interest, it would always wind up when I would meet these guys, that at the end of the conversations, they would say, you know, I feel like it's my obligation as a Muslim to invite you to come to Islam. And I would say, you know, thank you very much. I'm a student of Islam, but I'm not really willing, ready to convert or anything. But they could sense that interest, and they responded.
Yeah, they certainly did respond. And as you said, too, I think this is true of talk shows as well. People like to talk about themselves. So if you have a genuine interest in getting to know who somebody is, they're going to open up to you a little bit more, perhaps.
Definitely, definitely, definitely. People do. I mean, people do love to talk about themselves. And so if you could just get a couple of, you know, biographical nuggets about someone before you go to meet them, and then just start asking them to tell stories about themselves, and then you can sort of move into, you know, well, who else do you know, and, you know, what do you really think about this? And then people begin opening up.
Right. You also mentioned, and this was true of people considered terrorists and just people in politics, all kinds of people, that hospitality, I've always said that about Ireland, how hospitable it is. Mm-hmm. You say it about Pakistan, that no matter who you're dealing with, for the most part, people are phenomenally hospitable.
Exactly. And you know, a friend of mine, a Pashtun friend of mine, who lived in Swat, made this comment on this one night that, you know, this hospitality is killing us. The problem is that people are so hospitable to you, but yet these same people are so hospitable to, you know, Arab al-Qaeda people. So mm-hmm. There was this evening when I was in Swat in October of 2007, and I met my journalist friend from Swat, and he had arranged for us to go and have dinner at the house of a local Taliban commander. And so we drive out to this guy's house. We're about 4 hours from the capital of Islamabad in the city of Mingora. Then we get in the car and we drive about another 2 hours way, way, way deep into this remote pine forest. And we're at this Taliban commander's log cabin. And it's during the month of Ramadan. We've just broken the fast together, and everyone is sort of feeling chummy and coming back to life after having not eaten for 12 hours. And this Taliban commander takes out his cell phone and begins showing me DVDs of al-Qaeda and Taliban attacking American convoys in Iraq and Afghanistan, which was very uncomfortable because my brother at the time was serving in Iraq, was a lieutenant in the Marine Corps. And so I was trying to figure out a way to change the subject, if you will. And we started talking about Islamic philosophy, and this guy said to me, well, do you know that Osama has written a book about philosophy? And I said, no, I didn't. So he said, okay, come into this other room. I want to show you some things. And he had a bookshelf in the other room that was loaded with all of his al-Qaeda and Taliban paraphernalia. It included a handwritten note by Mullah Omar. It included a huge stack of DVDs. It included all these, you know, various guns and stuff that had been given to him by al-Qaeda folks. And at the bottom, there was a backpack. And he said, actually, the philosophy book is in that backpack. He said, but I promised the person who left that bag that I wouldn't touch it until he returned. And so I sort of elbowed this guy. His name was Iqbal Khan. And I elbowed Iqbal, and I said, Iqbal, you know, who are you so worried about that you're afraid to touch the bag? And he said, well, this bag was left here by Ayman al-Zawahiri,
oh my gosh,
al-Qaeda's number two, you know. And he said, I don't know when he's going to come back to get it. And at that point, I looked at my journalist friend, and I said, I think we need to get back to the hotel, you know.
Oh, no.
And that's when he got in the car, and he said, you know, these guys are just, this hospitality is a, again, it's a double-edged sword. You know, the same way you felt very comfortable, you know, minus small instances of discomfort, overall the experience was a positive one. And this guy opened up to me, and I felt very comfortable in his house. And yet, he said, the problem is that just like he welcomes you as an American journalist, he also welcomes these Arabs.
Hmm. So. Right. So when you, there were lots of moments when you wondered, wait a second, what am I getting into? At what moments did you feel most uncomfortable?
Most uncomfortable was, without doubt, when I went back in August of 2008. So I was I moved to Pakistan in February of 2006. My wife and I were deported in January of 2008. And then I wanted to go back, and I felt like our deportation was, it was right at the end of Musharraf's time, and I felt like it was just kind of a knee-jerk reaction by the government that they didn't like the article, they'd kicked me out, but hopefully they would reconsider. And so I began lobbying in D.C. to convince the embassy to let me back in and take me off all the blacklist, et cetera. So that took a long time, and eventually in August of 2008, I went back. And midway through that trip, after all of the intelligence agencies had signed off on my visa and said, okay, we've got no problem with him coming back, midway through the trip, I was driving north out of Karachi into the province of Interior Sindh, and it was myself and a local translator and then a photographer. We were all working on a Smithsonian story. And we started getting phone calls from a guy using a cell phone, first pretending to be an Interior Ministry official, saying that he wanted to meet me, and then about a half an hour later, same guy, same cell phone number, said that he was a newspaper editor and he wanted to meet me. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, this is a page ripped right out of the Daniel Pearl mm-hmm. playbook. And mm-hmm. and so we got very concerned and made calls to the Interior Ministry, and they said, you know, this person who called you, that individual, nor does the office that he says he works for, none of them exist. So we again became very concerned and started getting calls from journalists in Karachi that said that, look, our intelligence sources are saying that the intelligence agencies are looking for you. And I said, yeah, no, I'm very aware of that. Right. But what's the problem? And they said, I don't know. Well, about a half an hour after that, a friend of mine in Islamabad was watching TV, and local television began reporting that I had been kidnapped in Karachi.
Oh, my gosh, Nicholas.
And so I didn't know at that moment whether they were forecasting intent, whether it was just a shot across the bow, what it was. But it was, I immediately decided that I needed to get out of there. But we were way up in the interior part of Sindh, far, many hours from Karachi. You know, Smithsonian had just sent me to Pakistan. I needed to at least go to this religious festival for a few hours and get some sort of, you know, some scenes for the story. But, you know, driving back into Karachi a day and a half later, and I was just a basket case, and every car that passed and the horn honked, I was jumping in my seat. Oh. And then the embassy, mm-hmm. the U.S. consulate got involved, and they said, look, we're picking up all these internal communications, and we know the intelligence agencies are watching you. We just can't tell whether they are the threat or whether they're trying to protect you from a threat. And so ultimately, the embassy or the consulate sent a black Range Rover and a bulletproof car, and I left in a bulletproof car, went to the airport. As I was sitting there in the departure lounge, I was trying to call my father, who's a Marine general, to tell him what had happened. And every time I began making the phone call and conveying the details, the phone kept cutting out.
Oh.
And I just thought, okay, this is it. This is the sign. If you know, it's one thing to be deported, but it's another thing if you have to be taken in a bulletproof car. That's when you say, okay, uncle, I'm done
yeah.
at this place.
I see your point. Talk more about those, the ISAI. You do say that you wouldn't trust them for anything. You do have friends there, but what they're lacking is unity and discipline. What role are they playing in Pakistan?
Yeah, well, they're playing whatever role they want. I mean, they're... Uh-huh. Yeah, the unity, the discipline all come into question because, like I said, I mean, the very, very senior leadership of the ISI and of the various other intelligence agencies had all signed off on my visa, and yet I'm 99% sure that the phone calls we were getting and the planted stories in the press were being done by mid-level intelligence agencies,
mm-hmm.
intelligence officers. So, I mean, the ISI originally was supposed to be for collecting foreign intelligence, but it's kind of like the CIA and the FBI, but much more nefarious, even wrapped into one, in that they both, you know, they rig elections in Pakistan. They also support, you know, jihadi organizations in Kashmir and in Afghanistan. The ISI, the problem with the ISI is that now, in the past year or two, they too, even though they were the ones that were feeding the Taliban and feeding the various jihadi organizations, they are now coming under attack. And so the ISI, I think, is going through an identity crisis. You know, they, you know, what, how do they pursue Pakistan's national goals in Iran, I mean, in India and Afghanistan, while not creating a monster that will ultimately eat them? And that's the problem they're having right now with the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to Daniel Pearl for a moment. It was only a couple of years before you got there, I think, that he was so savagely murdered. And I know his name comes up in conversation. I want you to tell me how you may have changed the work that you did and the contacts that you made and being given permission to go places as a result of his murder. I know that his name was brought up on more than one occasion as you were trying to maneuver your way through Pakistan.
Right. I mean, I arrived in February of 06, and he was killed in, I think, February of 02. But his ghost of Daniel Pearl is still very present and sort of is hovering over, particularly over Karachi, which is just this, you know, big, sprawling, frenetic city. How did I change? I mean, it's very difficult, and I'm in no real position to say what Daniel Pearl did or didn't do, right or wrong. But the one thing is that he didn't, in the end, when he went to meet this individual who was pretending to be a fixer and ultimately turned out to be Omar Sheikh, this notorious terrorist that led him to the kidnappers and almost to kill them, you know, he told his fixer, his local translator, that we all rely on, that us as foreign journalists really can't function without in foreign countries. And he told his fixer that, you know, this guy speaks English. Go ahead, you can stay home. I don't need you to come with me, which, you know, is a natural response. Why bring two people when you can do it yourself? The problem is that having that local journalist was so critical, and that was the lesson that I drew from, is that I always, always, always traveled with a local journalist. And it was another pair of eyes. It was another gut feeling. It was another sense, like my fixer when I went back in August, who looked at his cell phone and said, "This is weird. This guy is calling me from the Interior Ministry, saying he's an Interior Ministry official, but he's using a cell phone.
Right?
Government officials don't use cell phones." I mean, I would have never thought of that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was just that local sense and knowing that, you know, well, this road is not a road you go down after 7 p.m. or this neighborhood you don't travel in the morning or something. So that was, you know, I ultimately came to rely very much on these individuals all over the country. I had different fixers in different cities and even different neighborhoods sometimes.
And how did you find all those people?
It was all word of mouth. And it was
really all,
you know, knowing one journalist in Islamabad and saying, well, do you have any friends in Karachi? Going to Karachi and then saying, well, do you have any friends in Nawabshah or Larkana or various other cities? So kind of just, you know, using contacts and moving out. And this is what I mentioned in the beginning, was that over the first 6, 7, 8, 9 months that I was in Pakistan, I was kind of establishing, not intentionally, it was no grand scheme, but just establishing this network of fixers all over the country, so that when Pakistan began grabbing headlines in throughout 2007 and early 2008, I was already in a position where I could just kind of, you know, make a quick call, get on an airplane, get on a bus, and be in another town where the action was and have someone that was there waiting to help me.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Nicholas, and we'll take them in a moment. To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan is the title of Nicholas Schmidl's book. And we're welcoming calls at 800-486-8655. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation, writes for the New York Times Magazine, Slate, the New Republic, Smithsonian, Virginia Quarterly. And the book is the story of 2 years that he spent in Pakistan, 27 years old, going everywhere in the country, and giving us a look at the breadth of thought and in Pakistan right now. He returned. He had to leave in January, I believe it was, of 2008, and returned to the country, and then definitely had to get out of the country the following year. And we're welcoming calls for him. 800-486-8655 or talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Nicholas and start with Jerry from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. I'm interested in an article that was in Smithsonian last winter that was about the extent of Sufism as an influence in Pakistan. And listening to your guest, perhaps your guest was the author of it. And
I think you were, weren't you, Nicholas?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
I would like to ask him what influence Sufism does have. The article said that Sufism was the dominant branch of Islam in Pakistan. And I would think that that would be a very good base to build on for a different direction.
Yeah, you know, that's a fantastic question, and that was the whole idea of me going back in August to report this story. And this is kind of how I was able to also convince the government to let me go back. I said, you know, Sufism is the indigenous bulwark against the spread of the Taliban, and I feel like this is a sort of soft side of Pakistan story that hasn't been told. And I do believe, I mean, the Sufis definitely have the numbers. The Taliban have the guns, they make the headlines, but Sufism does represent probably the majority of most Muslims kind of follow this very individualistic relationship with God, not so doctrine, etc. The problem is that the Taliban feel that Sufism is a direct threat to them. So even in the Swat Valley, there was a Sufi poet who his name was Rahman Baba, and one of the first things that the Taliban did after taking over Swat was to go and occupy his shrine and to say no one else will come into the shrine, because frankly that undermines their authority, that the Taliban and these sort of obscurantist clerics' authority to tell people what Islam is and isn't, when in fact the Sufis are saying Islam is whatever you feel, it is your relationship with God. And so when we attended this festival, it was just amazing. Hundreds of thousands of people just dancing and singing. I mean, it was like a you know, music festival. And everyone had this very, very, I mean, they were all just sort of locked in and zoned out. And of course, you know, the very prominent smell of hashish was wafting through the crowd. So, you know, call it a contact buzz, call it what you want. But at one point, this was after we were being sort of chased by phone calls and freaked out by the intelligence agencies. I just stopped outside of the shrine as everyone was dancing and the drumming was going on, and kind of closed my eyes and realized for a second, you know, I know now why people travel all over the country sitting on the top of buses to get to this festival. You lose yourself. Huh. And so I think I still stand by the fact that that is the most powerful sort of indigenous, potential bulwark against the rise of the Taliban.
Huh. Did you have anything else, Jerry?
No, thank you.
Yeah.
A very nice answer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was. Thanks very much for the call. And I think that it is a very underreported story. I don't know what we do with that. What do we do with that? The fact that so many people are so moved by Sufism and practice it, and you lose yourself in that kind of celebration. Is that, what difference does that make to us in how we treat Pakistan?
The thing is, It gets back to the fact that there's nothing that we can really do. I mean, we as the United States, I mean, the public diplomacy programs, I mean, if you start promoting Sufism and there's some sort of, you know, State Department promotion
yeah.
of Sufi festivals, then it's never going to work. The thing is that the Taliban are their own worst enemy. And when they start going into Swat and they start destroying the shrines and they, you know, start sort of trying to undermine the culture, the traditional culture that's been there for hundreds of years, even though they're in the short term exerting their authority and dominating that area, they're in the long term undermining their ability to be able to exercise control over the population.
Mm-hmm. And what is it that they're dominating? What needs to flourish? Tell me about what they're finding when they get there.
Well, I mean, if we go back to the example of Swat, I mean, there were a number of ways that the Taliban were able to take over, one of which was that Pakistan is the distribution of wealth and income is terribly disproportionate. And unlike in India, there has never been significant land reforms in Pakistan. So you have landowners that are sitting on, you know, hundreds and thousands of acres with literally serfs living on the land, and these landlords are both, they are employer, they are banker, they are judge, and they are priest, all sort of wrapped into one. And so the Taliban were able to come in and say, you know, why are you listening to these people? You all should, you know, rise up against them. And so this is one. I mean, so to that extent, it was kind of almost a class war. But they were also able just to say that, look, the government doesn't care about you. The justice system is very slow. You know, people that have been caught for murder or kidnapping are, you know, never even put to trial. So the Taliban said, you know, we'll take care of them. We'll lash them. We'll kill them. Whatever. And so they were able to tap into a great amount of discontent in these areas.
Mm-hmm. And tell us more. It seems to me as though you were in danger's way many, many times. But tell us more about this trip to the Taliban camp that you took and the road that you took to get there and
right.
where you stayed. And I'd be scared to death, Nicholas, so, doing all of this.
If we go back to, so I spent 3-4 days in the Swat Valley in October of 2007, and more or less as a guest of the Taliban. None of my meetings would have been in any way possible had they not consented to me being there. So the first night is when we met this guy who had Ayman al-Zawahiri's backpack and Osama bin Laden's book of philosophy. So this was on the first day. 2 days later, we called the same guy and we said, okay, listen, Iqbal, we've gotten an invitation to go to the Friday prayers and to spend a day at the camp of Maulana Fazlullah. And now Maulana Fazlullah is the warlord who has been responsible for most of the violence in Swat over the course of the past 2 years. And I'm the only journalist who has met him since he began fighting the government. No other journalist has seen his face since I did in October of 2007. And so Iqbal Khan's response to us is, there's no way I'm going with you guys. Those guys over at Maulana Fazlullah's camp are extremists. And you realize at this point that, you know what? The Taliban are far less united than everyone thinks. And this was actually, this all fed the Times Magazine story, the New York Times Magazine story I wrote, talking about this next generation of Taliban and the emergence of this generation that was no longer under the authority of the traditional religious and tribal structures. So to get to this camp, there were two ways from the main city. You could either drive, you needed to get across a river, and you could either take the bridge and go all the way around and kind of take the long road and also in the process go through a number of towns and villages that were controlled by the Taliban. Or you could take a short road, follow the road that hugged the river a few miles out of town, park the car, and then load into a carriage, open-air carriage, that was attached to a zip line that was taking people careening across the Swat River from one side of the river to the other and dropping them in the middle of this Taliban camp. So, of course, that actually, oddly enough, seemed like the safer option at the time.
Sure.
So we loaded into this carriage and landed in the middle of this camp and spent the day there. And it was just, it was amazing. I think I described it as Taliban-a-palooza. I mean, there were PA systems that were playing jihadi poetry over the top. Everyone's walking around with long hair, floppy caps, Kalashnikovs, rocket launchers over their shoulders. And at the end of the Friday prayer, about 10 or 15,000 people that had come to hear the prayer all migrated to the other side, to another side of the river, and to a spot where the Taliban had erected a wooden platform on which they were going to administer their first bout of public justice, and they were going to do a public lashing.
Mm.
And so here I was standing there, and I thought, okay, it was so surreal.
Oh.
And I got the impression that there was no way that I was supposed to be seeing this. You know, like, you
right.
know, you're standing there and you're thinking, if anybody knew that I was standing here, they would really, really, really not like it, particularly the government. And so I thought, well, there's got to be a way that I can at least capture this, because I'm never going to be able to remember this image. And it was just so, like I said, surreal. So I took out my cell phone, thought about taking a picture. And right then the PA system came back to life. And the guy said, anyone who's seen taking pictures of this scene will be dealt with. And I thought, you know, if they're about to lash these guys, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to pull my cell phone back. And then they proceeded to march three young men. They were 18, 22, 21, something around there. And they marched these three guys up onto the platform and lashed them 25, 20, and 15 times.
For what?
Well, for their alleged role in a kidnapping. That a few weeks earlier there had been a kidnapping, a couple of women had been taken, and they were being ferried across the border to Afghanistan where they could potentially later be sold. And the Taliban got word of this. There was no police presence in Swat at the time. The Taliban jumped in pickup trucks. They raced across the mountains. They grabbed these guys and brought them back. I mean, this is their image that they were cultivating at the time as sort of modern-day Robin Hoods.
Mm.
And so, but you could sense the public desire for justice the guys were kind of executioners. They were wearing ski masks and carrying this long leather belt, and as he was lashing these individuals, as they get down to the final lashes, the whole crowd is yelling out, 5, 4, 3, like, you know, counting down the final seconds of a basketball game. And the lashing itself, I mean, it was brutal, and it looked terribly painful. But in fact, the lashing wasn't the worst thing. I would probably I'd rather take 20 lashings than spend, say, 20 years in a Pakistani jail. The bigger sort of what it symbolized more was just the government's writ had totally collapsed, mm-hmm. and then now the Taliban, they were manning checkpoints, they were administering public justice, and the government was nowhere to be seen.
Right.
So this was, you know, and so after this incident, I got back in the car and rode 4 hours back home, and I was back home in Islamabad, which is, you know, we dubbed low self-esteem abad because there was nothing to do and it was so boring. And it was, by the same token, I kind of came back and I never quite looked at Pakistan the same.
No, I'm sure you didn't. And was it your writing about the Taliban that got you kicked out, the article that you mentioned?
Yeah, you know, the article wasn't overly critical. It wasn't really directly critical of the government or of Musharraf, but what it did was that it offered a very, very, very different narrative of what was happening in the Northwest Frontier Province vis-a-vis the government's reaction to the Taliban, in that anytime the Musharraf or Pakistani government officials were in Washington, they were saying, the Taliban are coming, but we're doing everything we can, just give us more support. And this article showed that, you know what, the Taliban are coming, but the government's not doing squat. And they're actually pretty close, and they've taken over this area that is not—it's not even part of the tribal areas. It is nominally administered. It's part of Pakistan proper, and it's supposed to be, you know, policed by Pakistani policemen and governed according to Pakistani laws, and it's not.
Because
you know, this all came back. In fact, this all you could trace back to the Red Mosque and the uprising there in the summer of 2007. So right after that happened, and after my associate Abdul Rashid Ghazi was killed, the country just went up in flames, and the Taliban and SWAT began attacking the police checkpoints. And after a few weeks, you know, with hundreds of police having been killed in suicide bombings, the police said, you know, screw this, we're going back to our bases. So the police then stayed back in their bases. The Taliban hadn't quite come out in force on the streets, and so there was a brief period when the kidnappers and the bandits were out, and then the Taliban sort of took over, you know, then the Taliban rose up and said, okay, well, we're now going to conduct the policing. And it was whether this was the idea from all along, it was a very systematic plan on their part. And you know, that's kind of how the government moved out and they moved in.
Did you feel like you were living in another century when you were at that camp, Nicholas?
It was, I don't know where, I didn't know where I was living. Actually, there was one point when, as we were waiting for the lashing to begin, and I'm standing there with my notebook, and I'm wearing all local dress, and I was dyeing my hair, and, you know, I was only speaking Urdu so that just everyone knew that I wasn't from Swat, but at least if I was speaking Urdu and I had brown hair, you know, those people have fairly light complexion. I was wearing local clothes and all that. They didn't think immediately, you know, this guy is definitely an American. Let's go after him. And so I'm standing there taking notes, and first of all, this guy comes up and looks over my shoulder with a long beard and asks me in perfect English who I was working for. And I said, I was writing for the New York Times. Why? I said, how do you speak such great English? And the guy said, well, I used to live in Louisiana and Texas, and I was working at various barbecue joints before Maulana Fazlullah took over SWAT. I'm from SWAT, and I decided that this is where my heart really was, and so I came back.
Oh, my gosh.
And so this is kind of still in my mind. And then all of a sudden, these three pickup trucks that were carrying the kidnappers and those who would conduct the lashings, when these three pickup trucks came barreling out of the hills, and they were racing towards us near the platform, and they were kicking up these huge clouds of dust, and they opened the doors, and, you know, it's all dusty, and I thought, okay, at this point, anything is possible. I said, I would not be surprised if the tall Saudi with the long beard and the $50 million price tag on his head comes out of one of these cars. Because it was just, I mean, like you said, it wasn't, I don't even know where it was, a century. I feel like I was on another planet for a few hours.
Right. Hey, I gotcha. Let's go to Jerry next from Madison. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your guest. I was wondering what the genesis of the Taliban is. Is it Wahhabism, perhaps?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, ideologically, the Taliban, the madrasas, the Islamic seminaries that sort of birthed the Mujahideen in the 1980s, and then that were, of course, you know, backed by the CIA and strongly supported by the Americans. And the Mujahideen at one point were referred to by Ronald Reagan as being the founding fathers of Afghanistan. You know, when they sort of transformed into the Taliban 5-10 years later, in the absence of law and order in Afghanistan and after the Americans had left, they were coming out of madrasas that belong to the Deobandi sect. The Deobandi sect is a South Asian, is the sort of most conservative indigenous South Asian sect. I mean, Wahhabism is not indigenous and is not natural to South Asian Islam. But many of these Wahhabi madrasas were funded and supported by Wahhabi money, by Saudi intelligence, and by individual donors over the course of the 80s, 90s, and even today.
Anything else, Jerry?
Oh, no. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Nicholas Schmidl. His book, To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. And we have an email address, too, you can use if you want to. And that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nicholas Schmidl is our guest. Feel free to join our conversation. Any questions you have about Pakistan, and perhaps some of you have had a chance to read his really gripping story of arriving in the country, learning Urdu, crash course in that, because actually he thought, oh, we'll have to ask him that story. He was going to Iran, but couldn't because of what was going on in Iran and Ahmadinejad, so he went to Pakistan instead. And his being an intrepid reporter and going all over the country, including Taliban camps and eventually being kicked out of the country and then returning and needing to get out of the country for being able to preserve his life, actually. So that's what we're talking about this hour. And you can also send an email. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We should talk about you were going to Iran first, right? And then Ahmadinejad was elected. Is that what happened?
Right. Well, I was a grad student in 2004 and 2005. And I, in the summer of 2004, had a teacher who had decent connections with reformists in the Iranian government at the time. And there was a program at the University of Tehran for learning Persian. And so I enrolled in this program. I got a visa. I spent the summer in Tehran. I actually was living in the very dormitories that were stormed by the militias 2 weeks ago. Mm. And it was just, it was an amazing, amazing, amazing summer. And I developed really good contacts within the clerical, senior elements of the clerical community that are based in Qom, which is 2 hours south of Tehran. And so I came back and I received this fellowship. Originally, they wanted to send someone to Iran. So I got the fellowship to go to Iran. And then a week after I received the fellowship, Ahmadinejad was elected. And the Iranian intersection, you know, there's no official diplomatic presence in either country. So the intersection there just said, look, you know, you're never going to get a visa from the new Ahmadinejad government to go spend 2 years in Iran roaming around
right.
with money from an obscure foundation looking at our identity and ethnic problems. They're like, it's never going to happen. So,
yeah.
So I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe I didn't know anything about Pakistan, but I knew that there were identity and ethnic factors at play and that were significant. So I kind of went back to the foundation and said, can I go to Pakistan instead? And they said, well, you don't know anything about Pakistan. And I said, well, yeah, just give me a little time. So that's how it was an accidental arrival.
Huh. Let's go to Marilyn from Madison next. Hi, Marilyn.
Oh, hi. I wanted to say this is such a riveting program. Thanks for having him on, and I want to read his book. I wondered if he was aware of the American who is building schools in Pakistan, and I wonder if that American's life would be in danger because of the situation.
Right. So I believe you're referring to Greg Mortensen, the author of Three Cups of Tea, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, he, I don't know too much about sort of how much he's still there now, but I mean, he's he has developed an incredible base of support in some of these villages that, you know, certainly he would be in danger. No one is immune anymore, and that's very, very clear from, you know, Prime Minister, two-time former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. She can be assassinated in the city where the army is based, and, you know, senior Taliban commanders can be assassinated by one another. I mean, no one is really immune from this. But having that base of support in these villages is very important. And people, like I said, it goes back to the hospitality thing. Your hosts will protect you. This is what Abdulrashid Ghazi, the head of the Red Mosque, said to me one time when I first got into his office one day. And there was an AK-47 leaning against the wall, and there was a pistol sitting on the couch right next to where he was sitting. And my eyes were sort of looking back and forth. And he said to me, "Relax, my friend." He said, you're a guest of mine. He said, "If you would come in here, you know, with guns and yelling and saying, I need to meet Ghazi, it would have been a much different story. But you came in here as a guest. I've invited you. If anyone comes into this room now and says that they want to take you, I will use those guns against them."
Well, that is reassuring.
It was one of those things where I was like, you know, there's going to be a lot of gunfire if something happens, but I'd rather not be in this room. But you did, in his presence, and this gets back to kind of, you know, the notion of these charismatic leaders. I mean, in Ghazi's presence, I felt very freakishly safe, frighteningly safe. And it was one of those things, too, where I began to understand why these kids were flocking to him. It was as much about being with Ghazi and feeding off of his charisma as it was about jihad, as it was about Islam, as it was about any of the sort of the grander ideas that they were ostensibly fighting for.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marilyn. You'll enjoy his book, I'm sure. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. You devote time to telling his story in the book, Nicholas, and he's a fascinating character. He worked for UNICEF at some point?
Yeah, in 1998, the same year that he went with his father to Kandahar, Afghanistan, to meet Osama bin Laden, he was also an employee of UNICEF.
My.
And he had a master's degree in international affairs from one of the main prominent secular universities in Islamabad. And he was quite a dynamic character. When I've told him one day, probably in our second or third meeting, I realized who he reminded me of, and it was none other than Jerry Garcia.
Yeah, right.
And I told him, actually, I said, you really remind me of this guy, Jerry Garcia. And he looked at me and he said, "Who's Jerry Garcia?" And I said, "Well, you know, he's this guitarist of this band, the Grateful Dead, and they tour, and people, you know, do a bunch of drugs and dance at the concerts," and he kind of got this huge kick out of it and thought this was the funniest thing he'd ever heard in his life.
It was a pretty, I mean, think of the circumstances. Here you are
telling this jihadi guy that he reminds me of a hippie, you know?
I know, and there is a picture of him in the book.
Right.
So people can see whether or not he does indeed look like Jerry Garcia, right?
And it was as much the demeanor, too. It was the sort of the shyness and the easy smile as much as it was, you know, the thick gray curls, the glasses, you know, so.
Right. So what did you think? I know that you respond to this because everybody asks this question, but we've heard so often that we got a real country that's sort of hard to understand, that's sort of hard to figure out where the truth is. It's an incredibly dangerous place. Money's going to the wrong places that we give in aid. What should we be doing there, if anything?
Well, I think, I mean, fortunately for fortunately for Americans, ideas and goals in Iraq and in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the Taliban actually have done a great amount in the past few months of helping us, because they, getting back to my point earlier about them, you know, being their own worst enemy, they overplayed their hand a few months ago when they left from Swat and they moved into a neighboring district that brought them to within 60 miles of Islamabad. I was just talking to a military official yesterday who said that it was on that day when they moved in, the Pakistani army finally realized that, you know what, the Taliban are for real, and if we don't do something soon, the existence of the country is at risk. And so apparently a senior Pakistani general wrote out this memo that said, you know, we need night vision goggles, we need helicopters, we need air support, we need predator drones, we need everything. And we needed it, like, yesterday, because these guys are serious. this military official yesterday described it to me. He said, you know, it was kind of like the scene in Almost Famous when they're in the airplane and they're encountering turbulence and everyone is saying their last goodbyes and how much they love each other. And this one guy screams out, I'm gay. And then all of a sudden the plane straightens out and everyone looks back and turns around at him. And he said that this is a kind of a similar response. And all of a sudden after this happened, the U.S. went back to the Pakistani generals like, oh, yeah, actually, we didn't need that quite as much as we said. We've got everything under control. But, so that the Taliban, that conquest really brought the Pakistani army, and they're the only ones who can actually win this war against the Taliban. And it brought them, I think, a little bit closer to where we think they should be in terms of not appeasing the Taliban, in terms of taking them on in certain areas. But the problem is, the change of will might not actually match a change in capacity. And I don't know that the Pakistani army can right now remain deployed on the border of India, where they will be infinitely because of this sort of cosmic struggle between the two countries, can also remain in Swat and can also be, dominating the Taliban in South Waziristan, which they're going to try and do now. So it's become an issue where now they want to do everything, but they just don't have the tools.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you, just because of the enormity of the story, and you've spent time in Iran, what do you think?
I think that it is unfortunately potentially sputtering somewhat. The problem is that you the students and those who have been protesting are looking desperately for leadership, and I don't know that Mir Hussein Mousavi, the presidential candidate who was apparently defeated but who has become sort of a symbol for the resistance, I don't know whether he can fill that role. And I don't know whether, even if he could fill that role, and if there could be some significant change, whether he could ever match the expectations and the hopes of the people who are out sacrificing themselves in the streets right now. But it's not over. I mean, there are still major, major divisions within the senior... there were only 7 grand Ayatollahs in Iran as of a few years ago. And 3 of them have come out as vociferous opponents of Ahmadinejad and Khamenei's actions in the past several weeks. I mean, these are people that were the founding fathers of the Islamic Revolution. So there is a legitimacy crisis at play. The legitimacy of the state's been called into question. So it's not over, and yet it seems like the regime is consolidating their power, consolidating their grip. And I think that the unfortunate thing is that the government that will emerge will be a very different, a much more hardline, a much less pragmatic regime than the one of 3 weeks ago.
Mm. Let's go to Rick from Madison. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks
for the program.
Sure.
I had a thought, and it came from the statement of your guest that said, I'm not going to go to that camp. Those guys are extremists. And I'm wondering, do you suppose the U.S. and world focus on this is askew or off-center? Because maybe my thought was that the U.S. and other forces are really just a pesky nuisance to the people of the Taliban, the Swat Valley, that area, because their focus is to gain power. So what they're really focusing on is, I'm going to have to take my clan and fight that clan once these guys are out of here. It's kind of like me against my brother against the family, my family against the clan, my clan against their clan. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you bring up a good point, and that is, I think this is what you're asking, kind of how do the Americans and the Pakistanis, what do they do about the infighting? What do they do about the divisions within the Taliban?
Sort of. It's like we're seeing that they are against us, and that's their only problem.
Right.
And we have to crush them, when actually we're just a newcomer to the party, and they have disliked for millennia, generations, these other people, which are of their country, but of a different clan or a different...
You know what's interesting, and this is a major subject of debate amongst the senior Pakistani Taliban commanders. Most everyone agrees, that all of the so-called Mujahideen and Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the ones they should be focusing on are the Americans and the NATO forces in Afghanistan. And this is what the sort of the old guard Taliban says, Mullah Omar, the Afghan, the base of the Afghan Taliban. The problem is that the new generation of Taliban are focused on Pakistan. you know, and this is due to increased influence by foreign al-Qaeda elements that are in these camps. And so the Americans are actually the only thing that people kind of agree on, that, okay, well, you know, the American, we all know that we would love to be fighting the Americans in Afghanistan, but you know, people like Beatullah Massoud, under the influence of senior al-Qaeda leaders, realize that the stakes are much greater in Pakistan, that if they can grab power in Pakistan, it's a bigger country that, you know, I
Oops. Hello? I don't know what happened, but we have to say goodbye anyhow. Thank you very much, Nicholas. You won't hear this because we lost the connection, but thank you very much for being with us. Nicholas Schmidl, To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan is the name of the book. Well worth a read. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing The Hour, and thanks to John Treader and Jalema Noel for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. We'll be with you tomorrow on the Ideas Network.